Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lamb today is consumer expert Grace Goulston. And coming up, Grace has been to sniff out eBay's new trainer authentication center, but will it stop the flood of fakes to the market as sales boom? Simon takes aim at the smart people who choose to inflate house prices. We ask if Prime Day is better than Black Friday, or are they both a load of rubbish? Are confidence driving courses worth the money? What are the best value vehicles for young people to get cover and move over crypto? Is space tech the new cool investment kid in town? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, I'll be honest with you, Grace. I'm not really a shoe person, but I understand there are a lot of people who are, especially trainers, if you take a look at Instagram, and not cheap ones either. Some people are even viewing them as investment pieces. But as with anything popular, when it comes to money, in comes the scammers, and trainer fraud is big. So eBay have opened its first authentication center. It's in London. It focuses on high-value shoes, and our Grace went to visit it. Grace, just first and foremost, set out the problem that eBay is looking to fix. If you're like me and you just think, you know, 60 whatever quid on a pair of trainers, do the job, you know, is it such a big deal?
Well, they are focusing primarily on what they call sneakers. And I say sneakers not to be difficult, but I have been informed that if you are someone who is very interested in high value, what we would call trainers, even in the UK, they call them sneakers. And these people are really, really invested in what they do, what they buy, and basically the whole sneaker culture. And the problem that eBay is looking to fix essentially is the high number of counterfeit sneakers that are going onto their site. Now, they wouldn't tell me exactly the fake rate, they call it, of how many fakes there are to genuine articles on the site, but essentially pricey sneakers over £150 are often replicated by scammers who try and make a quick bit of money by faking very popular trainers and selling them online. And I mean, I was there. I saw some of the fakes. I saw some of the genuines. I'm no expert, but they are really, really good fakes. You cannot tell the difference unless you are an expert. And this is where the problem lies, is that people are buying them, paying lots of money, sometimes even thousands of pounds on trainers, to then find out when they want to sell them on, once they've, you know, hit a higher value as they've held onto them for 10 years, that they were fakes. And it can be a real disappointment.
Right, so the big issue is about investment as opposed to, I mean, if you can't tell the difference, surely in terms of just running about, they're okay.
That's exactly what I asked. I did exactly ask that question. With designer handbags, I think I have been guilty in my younger years of going somewhere like Barcelona along the beach, picking up a fake designer handbag, hoping none of my friends could tell the difference, passing it off as real. Not so interested in doing that now, but a lot of people still are. So I did say to the people working at the authentication centre, you know, what really is the problem? If someone wants to spend £100 on a pair of fake trainers that might retail for £300, they're saving themselves some money. They look the same. Where does the problem lie? And they said, for example, they're never going to last as long. They're not made from the same sort of good quality materials, which is why people pay a lot to begin with. They're long-lasting shoes. Secondly, a lot of people work two jobs, I'm told, save up a lot of money for a lot of time in advance of a launch they know is coming out. They're going to put away as much money as they can. They're going to buy these pair of trainers. A lot of people will put them in the cupboard, in their box, not touch them, maybe 5-10 years down the line, hope to sell them on. But they're really passionate about it. And for those who then find that they have been sold a fake, a counterfeit product, it can be devastating. And it's also, a lot of it is about passion. Now, as someone myself who doesn't have a passion for trainers, I can understand it. But for these people, it really is a lot of their lives, actually.
Well, exactly. I mean, just replace trainers or sneakers or plimsolls or whatever with something that we care about. And actually, look, who are we to say how people should spend their money? And they should genuinely expect to have decent quality stuff. And I suppose for eBay as a business decision, it sort of makes sense because it wants to be seen as reliable given what it does. You know, it allows other people to sell their products. And if it gets a reputation for selling fraudulent products, then it's, you know, it's not great for eBay. But where I want to know is, What was this site like, and where is the cost falling? I mean, are they going to add extra pennies on to people's purchases? Because I imagine it's not cheap to have a whole authentication site just for sneakers.
Yeah, absolutely. The centre itself is quite a big operation. It's a fairly big warehouse on an industrial estate. There's a lot of workers in there, each with their own station, each person checking a pair of sneakers over to see if they're real or not. It's a very swift process as well. You know, the boxes of trainers come in, someone unpacks them very carefully, checks that the boxes are as they should be. Mm-hmm. How would you know the difference between a cardboard box that's real or fake? They do. It moves on to the other side of the warehouse where someone checks it over, deems it fake, not fake, before it's then handed over to the packaging team, who then repackage it, make sure it's all safe, and send it back out to the buyer. Where the cost lies is with eBay. It is absolutely 100% free to the consumer. So the people selling will send it for free to the warehouse, and then the warehouse will then send it free, if all checks are made correctly, onto the buyer. As you say, you know, it's an expensive operation to run this warehouse. It was certainly a very fancy warehouse, looked brand new to me. But I think, as you say, ultimately, eBay don't want to get a bad reputation. So they're investing in their own reputation by paying for this. More people are going to be happy to buy online if they're sure that it's going to be genuine and not fakes. That's going to build business for them. And it's ultimately going to come full circle. And I think it works well for them. And as I saw, it'd only been open for 2 months and they had loads of business already. So it's clearly working quite well.
Do you know, I looked at this story, Grace, and I thought, I don't really know about trainers. I don't know what I'm going to say about this. But honestly, I'm fascinated now, because what I want to know is, you know, how do they test them? Because, you know, without pulling them apart, because they're such good fakes, these ones, how do they properly test them to make sure they know? What happens to the shoe if it's found to be fake? Is it sent back? Are the police involved?
So, yeah, there's a number of tests. I watched one person check it, but I couldn't stand there for the whole thing because they do take their time over it to ensure it's carefully. But I mean, a lot of the tests, firstly, as I said, they look at the box. They look at the plastic used in a box. And if the plastic doesn't match what Adidas would put in theirs, they know it's a fake. So it's incredibly precise. Things with the trainers, they look at the labels, they look at the stitching. They do a sniff test, which is one of the more interesting ones. I had a go, and I smelled a fake and I smelled a real. The real ones smell like tennis balls. New soles smell like tennis balls. The fakes have a far more chemically smell, a bit like nail varnish. I'm told that's as a result of using cheaper glue. And I mean, the cheap glue is also then used for like the sole. You can tell by the stitching as well, apparently, if the stitching is coherent the whole way around, you know, how big the lines are in between it and that sort of thing. They also look at the sole of the shoe. They look at the insole. They pull it apart a little bit to see if the glue looks the same. It's incredibly in depth. And these people that do it are experts.
I was gonna say, this is supposed to be a big business. I mean, where are these coming from? Have we got factories built? It must be. It's not someone in their bedroom, is it, stitching a couple of trainers together, is it?
I think a lot of the fakes are people who make them, you know, in bulk. They're not just people making one pair of shoes at a time. They are people who put them out consistently. If they are found to be fake, they go over to another table in the warehouse where they will contact the seller. Often the seller won't know that they're selling on fakes. They might have bought them themselves and are then, you know, selling them on for a higher price tag. Others, I think, would know, definitely. They get a warning the first time, and then eBay said they'll take further steps if it continues to happen. They wouldn't say what that was, but we know in general, not just people that sell sneakers, that they can get banned from the site for a period of time or forever. So that's what would happen. And they did say that some people as well, like, it's not just fakes. Someone might accidentally send two left shoes compared to a left and a right because they are selling both the genuine people. Yeah. And they just box them wrong. And again, they can't send that on to the buyer. So it's a very big operation, and it is really interesting. And I think it's an insight into a community I've never had before, but clearly there's big money in it.
Simon, there's so much in this. Your views?
Yes, let's unbox it, shall we? Oh. See what I did there. Firstly, the term sneakers always makes me think of a wonderful Simpsons episode moment where Grandpa Simpson is investigating at the care home. He turns detective and he says, "I noticed Malloy wore sneakers for sneaking." which is just something that always makes me think of. Probably not Americans, because they've called trainers sneakers all the time. But I didn't know that if you were into the whole investing in trainers thing, then you definitely call them sneakers. But I had actually, what coincided with Grace going off to eBay was I had an email from StockX. StockX is the global resale platform for sneakers, streetwear, and collectibles. Okay, so if you're not selling on eBay, maybe you might be selling on StockX. You're also quite likely to be selling on Depop too, I suspect. Now, it claimed that 1 in 3 sneaker buyers at 37% were motivated to purchase based on the potential investment return. And I quote here, assets like Air Jordan 4 sneakers are less volatile and tend to consistently appreciate over time, outperforming the FTSE 100 and S&P 500. Air Jordan 4 sneakers saw 100% growth over a period of 12 months. On average, an investor with 10 pairs of top-selling Jordan 4s would have seen a £1,416 gain. If we were to compare StockX assets to the FTSE 100 index, which is down slightly since January 2020, our four alternative asset indices, Air Max 1s, Jordan 4s, KAWS figures, and basketball cards, have appreciated between 50% and 200%. I mean, why is any idiot out there buying shares? Why are they not just buying sneakers? The answer is, as part of a diversified portfolio, don't just buy sneakers. Like we said,
there's a lot of fakes as well.
About crypto, Bitcoin, all that other stuff. Yeah, don't just invest in sneakers. But there are people out there, as Grace said, who take this very, very seriously. And as with any alternative asset, if you look at it over a limited period of time, the returns can look super good. The same was true of art, wine, classic cars, Bitcoin, if you look on the right Thursday back to the right Tuesday, but not if you look on the wrong Thursday back to the wrong Tuesday. But if you spread, yeah, you need to spread it out over the long term, and you need to look at the volatility, and you also need to look at how easy it's going to be for you to buy and sell these things. Now, obviously, sneaker investing is a hot thing at the moment. There's lots of people into it. Just as there's lots of people into crypto investing at the moment, wine. But if you look at, so to bring wine into it, if you look back over time, you'll see that the appetite for these collectibles, alternative assets, whatever you want to call them, I'm not sure whether sneakers count as an alternative asset yet, but you know, people have been buying and selling these things for a long time. The appetite ebbs and flows, it wanes. Sometimes it's very hot, sometimes it's very not. And the problem is that whilst it may look great when everybody wants to buy and people think the price is going up, when the prices start falling, you might struggle to sell that piece of art, that bottle of wine, that pair of sneakers, and so on. But as with anything in the alternative asset space, provenance is absolutely everything. It's being able to prove the what you've got is genuine, the history of it. If you've got the history of it, then that really helps, especially with things like classic cars. You know, who owned it before you, who owned it before them, and all that really important details that you get with the car. The more bills you've got, the more evidence you've got in the classic car world. And I would probably say maybe in the sneaker investing world, if you've got, you know, if you've bought a pair of sneakers off someone, if you can then get them to send you the proof that they bought that pair of sneakers new or something, then that's going to give you a lot better kind of provenance when it comes to selling them on. Same is true of, like, you know, art, wine, things like that. The really interesting thing is we're seeing the kind of intersection now of crypto and blockchain stuff with NFTs. And it's like, how long is it going to be before NFTs start entering into the world of sneaker investing, classic cars, wine, art, and so on? It's already kind of, you know, dabbling around the edges and a way of proving that provenance. But it is quite interesting. And actually, I did look at StockX, and if you want to fall down a rabbit hole, then I highly recommend it. So, I mean, I'm not an expensive trainer kind of person. I'm not an expensive clothes kind of person, to be perfectly honest. I skateboard. I've skateboarded since I was, you know, six, seven years old. I wear skate shoes, always have worn skate shoes because they're the best things to wear for skating. I've dabbled with like things like Gazelles and stuff over the years, but always go back basically Bands. Pretty much to exactly the same pair of Etnies, low cut twos every time. But I had a look at StockX, and Vans was the obvious thing to search up. So I found a pair of Vans Skate Grosso Mid Supreme Monogram S Logo Red. Okay, so they're quite a garish pair of shoes. They're the Jeff Grosso. Jeff Grosso was a very famous skateboarder who sadly died all too young recently. Now, these trainers, apparently, price premium over the original retail price. And bear in mind that this isn't like Yeezys or anything like that, okay? These are trainers that average sale price of $127. Mm-hmm. Price premium over original retail price, 36.4%. That's over the last 12 months, and there's been 11 sales. There's loads of data here, and it shows you when the last sales were and the sale prices and things like that. There's a buy price, which is a bid price, £158. That's the lowest ask on them. And there's a sell price, which is £99. So somewhere in the middle lies the, you know, as you do with a spread on shares, lies the actual price. You could like keep just diving down into this.
I'm on it.
Is quite interesting that, you know, ultimately a not particularly famous pair of sneakers, albeit I think they are limited edition looking at the design of them and everything, and they do carry the name of Grosso, are selling, you know, you could have sold them for 36% more than you paid for them if you were lucky. I guess there's probably people who didn't manage to sell them for 36%. And a 36% return is not to be sniffed at, you know. So
yeah, there's some good ones here anyway. Right, we're gonna move on from trainers. Sneakers, I don't know, whatever. But we're going to stick with, you know, online shopping, because Amazon Prime Day is coming. Now, I think this is something I'm supposed to get excited about. It's 2 days of big sales for Prime members, so the key being to get non-members to sign up, I presume. But is it better than Black Friday? Or are they both a cynical way to get people to part from cash they don't have for deals they can probably get cheaper elsewhere at other times? Grace. On the case.
Yeah.
Answer me.
Prime Day, yeah, 2 days of offers for Prime members only. I did see a stat somewhere. I can't remember the source, I'm afraid. I think 48% of households in the UK do have some sort of Prime membership. So a lot of people can already take advantage of the deals, even if they don't sign up. Obviously, as you say, the aim being to get as many people to sign up to Prime as possible. Idealo, a price tracking website, has done some research into this and has found over the last 3 years, it compared the deals on a number of really popular items that people buy on these days. On the discount days, we've got Prime Day, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, all available on Amazon. It found that 54% of the time Prime Day has the best deals, 31% of the time Black Friday does, and 15% Cyber Monday does. Now, that is just comparing them to each other, not the other times of the year. So, I mean, if you're looking to go on a discount day, Prime Day would be the best day for you. However, it is absolutely worth looking around other sites, other stores on Prime Day, on Black Friday, on Cyber Monday, and any other time around it to see if you can get a better deal. I think one really good tip is, if you're looking for something specific, is to set up a price alert. It's something we've recommended before, but you can track it on sites to see how, you know, the price goes up and down over the year on the different sites, and whether actually on Prime Day you're making a really big saving or not. Ultimately, there will be some things you will save a lot on, but other things possibly not.
You might save, but clearly there's something in this for Amazon, and that's to get as many people to sign up to their subscription service, because presumably most of us forget, or inertia means we forget to cancel, etc. But actually, is Amazon, I'm being cynical, but is Amazon Prime actually pretty good? I mean, is it worth it?
I have Amazon Prime, and yes, I mean, I did a quick count over the, this is probably not something you'd want to admit, over the first 2 months of lockdown, March and April, I ordered 50 things on Amazon Prime to be delivered. Just me. That is a lot of things to be delivered when you're paying for free next day delivery. I wouldn't recommend it. I was clearly overspending. But I certainly make use of it. I watch stuff on Prime Video quite a lot of the time. I find they have really good films. I sound like an advocate for Amazon. I'm not trying to be. I just personally find it good. But I have to say, I don't think I've ever really bought anything on Prime Day before. I've had a look, but I've never really committed to any major purchase. I would say if you are looking for something like a Kindle, or an Amazon Fire Stick, you will always get a better deal on Prime Day on Amazon products. Yeah. And I have an Amazon Fire Stick. Again, I sound like I love Amazon. But I have an Amazon Fire Stick and they are really good. And if you can get them cheaper on Prime Day, that's definitely something to look out for. However, other big ticket items like televisions, treadmills, I think are super popular, barbecues, I would definitely look elsewhere, shop around if there's something specific and don't just go for the first deal that you find.
Yeah, I'll speak from personal experience about getting large gym equipment. Think really carefully, because after using it for a couple of weeks during lockdown, you may never use it again and it will just clutter up space you don't have. And don't worry about promoting Amazon. They're a little bit in my bad books for the fact that Amazon Prime particularly, I don't have it, the other half does, but I just don't like every time I buy something, it automatically goes default Amazon Prime, please buy this. That annoys me. And then also now I've noticed that they're going to paid delivery. Even when there's an option for it to be free, it automatically defaults to it being a paid delivery. So do remember, if you don't have Amazon Prime, to click the alternative, which is, yes, it might be longer. And I do think that they're taking longer to try and encourage you to get Amazon Prime, but make sure that you check the cost of delivery. So there you go. That's my little tip. And it slightly bugged me for the last couple of months. But anyway, from my gripe, Simon, to yours, because this week for your column, you've taken aim at Rishi and George Osborne, for those whose memories are short. Why?
Well, let's talk your favourite thing, Georgie, house prices. However, it can't have escaped many people's notice that there is something of a property boom going on at the moment. This is officially the world's weirdest property boom, I think, in that basically it's happening in the middle of a global pandemic that's still going on, for which in large chunks of the past year, it has actually been illegal to freely leave your house as you choose. Yet somehow people have managed to go completely bananas for buying homes, and properties are being bid up. There are sealed bids, bids over the asking price, and it's filtered through into house price indices. The nationwide house price index has property inflation running at more than 10%. The official index, if we call it that, the ONS, based on land registry figures, was out this week, and it showed actually a slight dip in annual property inflation from 9.9% in March to 8.9% in April. Now, it lags the other ones by a couple of months. It could be that by the time we catch up and end up with May's report, for example, which is the most recent one put out by Halifax and Nationwide, that it's back above, it's above 10% or back up. But it does mean that the property boom under Rishi Sunak has managed to top the inflation level, the highest inflation level seen under George Osborne's property boom in 2014, which was 9.4%. Now, to put some figures on that, the average house price is now £250,772, according to the ONS. On the 8th of July last year, when Rishi Sunak announced his stamp duty holiday, which in part has been credited with driving up house prices, the average price was £234,756. Now, the maximum amount that you can save from the stamp duty holiday is £15,000. The average house price is £16,000 higher. So you can see why some people are suggesting that those people who rush to buy after a certain point in this stamp duty holiday may be indulging in something of a false economy. And actually, it's even starker than that, because in order to save £15,000, you have to buy a house that costs more than £500,000. If you buy the average home, you wouldn't save anywhere near that. You'd save £2,500. So what's going on? Is this property boom just about the stamp duty holiday? Has Rishi committed the cardinal sin in our eyes that a chancellor can commit and wantonly drive up house prices, knowing that one of the great structural problems we face in this country is unaffordable homes and too high house prices and a dependency on the property market? George Osborne did this. If you recall, he really struggled to get growth going after the financial crisis when the Tories were voted in, and was getting lambasted for his austerity, meant we weren't getting any growth and everything like that. And then finally, he rolled the dice on the housing market with Help to Buy, triggered a little bit of a mini property boom. The thing about the property market and people moving homes, it encourages consumer confidence, it gets people spending, and we lifted ourselves out of the funk. But let's not only look at these two. Let's go back to another guy, Gordon Brown. The man who announced that boom and bust was over, only for the world to see a colossal bust, blamed on people buying US houses without the means to pay back those their mortgages. But, you know, those mortgages were sliced and diced and the investment stuff was done in the UK. But even in this country, everybody knew that house prices were booming in the early 2000s. And that was feeding through to all those consecutive quarters of growth that Gordon Brown was very fond of flagging that he was the chancellor for. And instead of acting to go, hang on a minute, a lot of these consecutive quarters of growth appear to be coming from people remortgaging their homes and then taking the money out and spending it. Maybe we should do something about it. He just sat back and did it. So why do smart people inflate house prices? I don't know. I think it's because it has the power to drive the economy. But it is definitely the wrong thing to be doing. And looking back at the stamp duty thing, I think that there is a mistake that Rishi Sunak made here. And I think that it's unfortunate because actually I think that cutting stamp duty was a good thing, resolutely a good thing. Stamp duty is far too high in this country. It costs way too much to move home. And it definitely discourages people from moving home. It is a bad tax. But the problem is that he made his stamp duty cut temporary. So it's time limited. So people rushed to take advantage, which means that it is inflationary. This is actually a textbook example of how markets and economics work in terms of sentiment, momentum, and inflation. And if he hadn't have time limited it, if he'd have just permanently cut it, people wouldn't have felt the need to rush to beat it. I mean, you would have seen a step up in activity nonetheless, but they wouldn't have rushed to beat it. You wouldn't have had the problem. So now we are running up against the fact that in 12 days' time, the stamp duty holiday starts to taper down. The maximum saving goes from £15,000 down to £5,000. It won't be on the first 500 grand of a property, it'll be on the first 250. And then it's till the end of September, at which point either it'll stop or there'll be some other kicking of the can down the road. I mean, maybe we're just going to taper it down and taper it down and taper it down and taper it down. Unfortunately, really, the best thing you could do is announce that basically this cut is going to be permanent. And say, yes, actually, all of the evidence does appear to point to the fact that high purchase taxes do put people off moving. So let's do something about that. Let's permanently cut stamp duty. The difficulty is that we've got house price inflation knocking on the door of double digits. Everybody's worried about that. It's hurting prospective first-time buyers. It's hurting people lower down the property market. And he'll get lambasted because he'll be cutting a tax that saves people buying more expensive homes the most money. And so we're going to end up lumbered with too high stamp duty for the foreseeable future, I suspect.
I got a little bit of sympathy, sort of got himself into a little bit of a fix there, because look, I imagine at the time when this stamp duty cut was first announced, he had a lot on his plate, right? And I think he probably thought, well, you know, the economic situation's not looking great. Stamp duty does bring in about £12 billion a year. Okay, not loads compared to all the other taxes we have, but you know, maybe we'll just have a temporary one and we can kick that can down the road and address it later. And then of course the whole thing went bananas and he's sort of in a bit of a fix now. Am I being too kind there?
No, I don't think you're being too kind. I mean, you have to remember that in both of these situations, the two chancellors that I spoke about here, Rishi Sunak and George Osborne, were facing emergency times. Osborne was at the tail end of the, you know, the financial crisis years, and Rishi Sunak, I mean, you know, was facing the coronavirus crash, which was unbelievable, the deepest recession since the Great Freeze of whenever it was. But by the time the stamp duty cut was announced, the property market was already rebounding much stronger from that initial lockdown freeze than anybody thought. And it was doing okay. There was plenty of evidence on the ground saying, no, things are actually okay here. And so the criticism has come that he poured fuel onto the fire kind of thing with the stamp duty cut. I mean, who knows what the truth of the matter is, because all of a sudden this rumour broke tail end of June last year. And it was suggested that actually he didn't want to do it, that he was mulling over maybe leaving it and doing it in the autumn and seeing how things played out. But once the rumour broke, he felt compelled to do it, because if everybody thinks that stamp duty is going to get a big cut in the autumn, then they won't buy houses over the summer. So you would have almost had a self-fulfilling prophecy that sort of sunk property transactions. But I mean, he still could have made the decision to just make it permanent rather than make it a holiday. I think that's my main criticism. He's not cutting stamp duty. Cutting stamp duty was, by my book, absolutely 100% right thing to do. Until Gordon Brown started tinkering with it, it was a flat 1% on all purchases above £60,000. We should just go back to the 1%, admit it's a bad tax, give up that revenue, get it in from somewhere else, from people spending more money, for example, when they move home. But time limiting it, I think it indicates that time limited policies are not good policies. And I think that we should learn from this one and stop time limiting policies in this way. Apart from lockdown, which should definitely be time limited.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, of all the decisions you made, this is the one that I've seen the most kind of column inches, and I imagine it's going to run for a lot longer. Was it the right decision? Wasn't it the wrong decision? Grace, we're going to move on because I want to know, did you drive to the eBay centre?
Sadly not, no.
The reason I ask you that is because you have been investigating something related to driving, something related to driving confidence. Now, I, like you, went 5 years without driving as well. And so when I first got in the car, it was nerve-wracking, I'm not gonna lie. Tell me your story and why you were looking into this.
Yeah, so I passed my test when I was 23, 6 years after my first attempt when I was 17, 18. Passed after a couple of attempts and have never driven since. So it'd been 5 years, and I heard about these confidence courses, which are essentially, you know, helping people who haven't driven for a while get back into the driving seat and driving confidently, because as you've just said, it's really nerve-wracking. I honestly thought I wouldn't remember how to turn the engine on, let alone actually drive around, genuinely. I wouldn't say I was a bad driver when I learned to drive, but obviously it's a very different experience when someone else is in a car with you with the ability to, you know, brake if you're going too fast or slow you down if you're speeding, that sort of thing. So I really wanted to check it out and see if 2 hours could really bring back hours and hours worth of lessons, which it was for me, if it could bring back all the knowledge that I learned to begin with and the confidence to drive, not just on industrial estates, but actually on the road, on motorways, and get back into it as if it was yesterday, as opposed to 5 years, really.
And did it all come flooding back?
Flooding back, no, but it did over the 2 hours. It was absolutely it was a really good thing to do. I'm really glad I did it. I started off very slow, as you can imagine. You sort of pulling away, remembering how to use the clutch properly and find the biting point. That was my main concern, because that was something I struggled with a little bit previously. But once you get going, it really is a bit like riding a bike. Once you have the confidence enough to realize, no, you're probably not going to crash into someone, yes, you can remember to check your mirrors properly. It did come back to me. And by the end of the lesson, I was doing, you know, 60 on a dual carriageway, which I had no even thought of doing. Yeah. I just wanted to go safely around Bedford Autodrome, hope for the best. But I managed to get back out on the roads, navigate some roundabouts, navigate actual traffic. And it was the first time I'd been in the car where the person sat next to me didn't have any control. So it was just me who had autonomy over the vehicle, which honestly was scary. But I really feel like it was absolutely worth the time doing it. And I would really encourage anyone else thinking about it to just take the plunge.
How much is it?
For the people who I did it with, which were drive doctors who were doing it with NFU Mutual, for a 2-hour session, it would cost someone £150, which might sound like a lot, but I mean, driving lessons themselves are around £30 an hour. So you're really not paying more.
This is where I'm confused. Wouldn't you just be better off calling a driving instructor for half the price and just say, I've passed, but can you just sit in the car with me and give me some pointers? Difference between the confidence one and just employing a local driving instructor for half the price?
I would say personally, if you had a driving instructor, they would likely, like me, I don't have a car, so I was in that person's car. A driving instructor's car would have dual controls. So you wouldn't be driving by yourself. Again, you could rely on someone else to brake for you. Yeah. In this situation, I couldn't rely on that. I could only rely on myself, which was part of the confidence. Yeah. Secondly, I would say a driving instructor obviously is there to instruct, whereas with these confidence courses, it's someone there, they ask you, what do you not feel confident in? Not just driving, but specific. So for me, it was, you know, roundabouts. Oh, panic. I don't know what I'm doing. There's three lanes. Where am I? So you address that. The man I did it with, Mark, was saying one person he did a confidence course with, for example, was a lady who didn't drive over lockdown. She was working from home, got back in a car, and then couldn't drive over bridges anymore. She didn't know why. It was a mental block. She just couldn't drive over any bridges. So for her two-hour lesson, it was not necessarily the confidence of driving. It was the confidence to drive over a bridge. Another person he dealt with was a man with early onset dementia who wanted to prove that he could still drive and be in control of the vehicle by himself and have the confidence to do that. A driving instructor is not trained in that. They wouldn't, I'm not saying they wouldn't know what to do, it depends who you have, but they're there to teach you the basics. This was to give you the confidence to drive alone.
Simon, I'm just wondering, do you think it's, if someone's been that long, and I speak from my own experience here, I went 5 years when I got back in the car with my dad. It was driving around actually country lanes that really did. Well, I learnt in London, so I wasn't really used to country lanes. But I had actually driven before that for years and years. I was a sports journalist. I drove everywhere, but then had a 5 year gap. Is there an argument to say these courses should be essential for anyone who hasn't driven longer than 1, 2, 3 years?
Maybe there is, actually. It's funny, you're the complete opposite of most people. So most people hate driving in London, and there's people who are very experienced drivers who really do not want to drive in London. And I'm not surprised, you know, to be honest. I grew up 25 miles outside of London. I'm driving, you know, from when I passed my test, you know, I drive into London. We drive into London all the time. And also my dad used to, you know, my dad grew up in London and used to drive through London all the time. He used to drive to work and stuff. And I've always been used to being driven around in London. So it's never been a big thing for me, but I know other people for whom it's like, no way am I driving in London. And I do think that actually things like this are really helpful and really important, maybe for people who have that kind of, I mean, I wouldn't recommend going and driving in London for fun, but maybe if you suddenly, you learned to drive in the countryside and all of a sudden you have to start driving into a city for work or something, then maybe courses like this would really help out, or, you know, the opposite way around. And I don't know whether they should be mandatory, because I don't know how you would manage to sort of prove that someone hadn't been driving, how you'd manage to enforce it. Also, I mean, there's a really big problem with people being able to get driving tests and things at the moment. So more pressure on the system might cause an issue. But I do think that raising awareness of the option and people taking on the decision to go and do it is probably a very good thing. I mean, I've never had a break in driving. I've always driven, I like driving kind of thing. So I can't picture it in my mind, that scenario. But there's loads of people that you speak to who will say, yeah, I passed my test and I just never did any driving. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, 10 years down the line, they're like, yeah, actually, I need to start driving now. And I'm quite nervous about it. And it, you know, the thing is, so basically, Britain has, depending on the report and depending on the year, Britain has either the safest or second safest roads in Europe. And that basically actually means that pretty much the safest roads in the world, right? So when you hear talk of road casualties plateauing and not coming down anymore, that's because we brought them down a long time before most other countries. And so we vie in top spot with Sweden for having the safest roads. Okay. And Sweden is more sparsely populated, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And there's talk of, well, what can we do to make our roads even safer? Now, there might be an argument that says you can't make them that much safer. We've actually done such a good job already that we can't make them that much safer. But there are things you can do like this that do work around the edges and will probably make them safer. And, you know, just make people feel more confident and probably just lead to less crashes and accidents and stuff like that.
Just want to ask Grace, how did it feel? Because when I went back to driving, oh my God, I missed it so much. I mean, mine was a back injury, but... It felt so good. How did it feel for you?
Yeah, weirdly, I have dreams about driving. That sounds strange.
Good dreams, bad dreams?
just dreams about driving. And I reckon it's like my subconscious trying to remember how to do it, if that makes sense. Weirdly, after those dreams, I was like, I really would like to get back into a car. And getting back into it, I was like, oh, this is really fun. Especially when you start going a bit faster, you're not going at 20 miles per hour anymore. And you realize, oh, actually, you know, it's like you can get from A to B a lot quicker than on the bus. Like I did miss it, definitely. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I live in London, so the prospect of me getting a car is very slim. But renting a car when I go on more staycations, which is likely, is now a possibility. And that was sort of what I wanted to get out of it. But yeah, definitely enjoyable, definitely worth doing for anyone who hasn't driven for a while.
Yeah, super eco people turn off now as I talk about how much I loved going back to driving. Simon?
There's a flip side to this, right? And which is an article that I've been meaning to write, actually, to do a feature on, which is it is getting increasingly difficult to enjoy driving on the public roads. Speed limits are lowered, speed cameras are there. In order to enforce the speed limits, I'm not advocating speeding here, there are more cars on the road. The problem is there are many more cars on the road, and every year that passes there are more cars on the road, which requires lower speed limits, more speed enforcement, and so on. And also modern day cars are faster, they're getting faster. So fast cars now are much, much faster than fast cars 10 years ago, and unbelievably faster than fast cars 20 or 30 years ago. And that means that in order to get the same enjoyment out of driving a car, it kind of, on the limit, it needs to be driven at a higher speed. But if you're driving at a higher speed, you are definitely breaking the speed limit in a modern day fast car, whereas you might not have been in a fast car from 20 or 30 years ago. So what can you do? Mm-hmm. Track days, right? So track days, people think of them as basically being like some 19-year-old hooning around in a Citroen Saxo with a massive exhaust. But actually, if you are a car enthusiast, then it might be worth you indulging your desire to drive and drive quickly with a track day rather than heading out and breaking the speed limit on the public roads. And, you know, there's lots of places that offer these kind of things, and you won't just be hanging around with teenagers in Saxos. You'll probably find there's lots of other like-minded older car enthusiasts there who just want to be able to drive their car, enjoy how it's meant to perform, without basically running the risk of seriously injuring someone.
Talking about teenagers with Saxos, Simon, is that a good value car for a younger driver to get cover? Let's run through this because you've been taking a look. It is notoriously expensive. I mean, we've spoken about people coming back to driving. What about those who've just passed? Very expensive, can run into the thousands.
You want a Toyota Aygo is what you want. Okay, that tops the list of the cheapest cars for 17-year-old motorists to insure. Okay, so basically, the cheapest cars, we have a list here. Okay, in at number 10, we've got the Mini Cooper. Average insurance cost for a 17-year-old, £941. I bet there's loads of 17-year-olds who are like, I'd kill to be able to get insurance for £941. Volkswagen Polo, average cost, £849. Ford Fiesta, £842. Sierra Ibiza, £824. Vauxhall Corsa, 808. Renault Clio, 741. Citroen C1, 699. Volkswagen Up, 697. Fiat 500, 682. And then the Toyota Aygo, £641 average cost. All small cars, you'll notice, all small hatchbacks do tend to be the cars driven by younger drivers. Although in my mind, there's a theory that I look back on from when I was 17 or 18 years old of, we all ended up driving these little hatchbacks. I think maybe younger drivers would be better off with a big car, like an estate car or something that's got a bit more space to fit their passengers in. It's bigger, so maybe it's safer, arguably. And as you might do as a teenager, you occasionally end up sleeping in your car. It's much more comfortable to sleep in. So perhaps your child doesn't need a Toyota Aygo. They need something like an old Mercedes estate.
Or a Peugeot estate, which was my first car. What I can say is it very easily fills up with a lot of clutter, though not great for petrol costs and all that sort of thing. And for your parents moaning at you. But anyway, finally, Simon, the race for space. I'm not talking about people moving across the country, pushing up house prices. The world's first investment trust focused on space technology is set to float in London, giving you and me, if we want, the opportunity to tap into what is predicted to become a $1 trillion market. Simon, it sounds super duper cool. Is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, cool.
It's a very interesting. It's a very interesting space at the moment. There's something of a space race going on. And the space race is being led by some of the world's best known businessmen. A certain Mr. Elon Musk is going head to head with a certain Mr. Jeff Bezos. And basically, they are trying to punt loads of satellites into space. And what do they want to do with these satellites? They want to blanket the world with internet coverage, better internet coverage. And there's lots of other companies involved in this. And there is a new investment trust, Seraphim Space Investment Trust, okay? Be managed by Seraphim Space, which runs with the strapline on its website of science fiction to science fact. And it is targeting an ambitious total annual investment return of 20%. So first thing first, anything that's targeting an annual return of 20% is going to be more volatile, more risky, and should only be a small part of your portfolio. Don't chuck all of your portfolio into the Space Investment Trust. Remember to put some in sneakers too. And it will boast a large portfolio of more than 50 space-related companies. It's going to acquire a portfolio of 19 seed assets from Seraphim Space Fund. And there's been described by the chair designate of the trust and former Virgin Galactic boss, Will Whitehorn. He says, there is nothing short of an industrial revolution underway in the space sector. Space tech is forecast to be a multi-decade trillion-dollar investment market that has not previously been available through listed opportunities. We are excited to offer investors access to a diversified portfolio of some of the sector's highest growth potential companies. Is it going to the moon? Who knows? It's a high risk proposition. An investment trust structure is well suited to this because, unlike a fund which can grow larger or smaller as money comes in or goes out and can be a forced buyer or a forced seller, an investment trust can bide its time. Much better to invest in a thing like this. It's IPOing, right? So there's a float. Is it good to buy in an IPO? Opinion is divided on that. Some people like to get in at IPO level. Some people like to let the market settle and the price settle and stuff. But, you know, you've got Musk, you've got Bezos, you've got our very own Richard Branson competing to offer space flights as well. It's not just satellites. Yeah. They want to be able to fly people into space. I mean, will we see a scenario where space tourism, just the ability to go up into the air, go into space and come back down, fills the gap left by more prosaic tourism, such as going to Portugal on holiday? I don't know. Rich man's plaything. But it's interesting because if you think back, I always think when you get on a plane, isn't it amazing how people pay absolutely no attention to the fact they're on a plane? They get on, headphones in, book or magazine out, eyes closed. A lot of them don't even look out the window. A lot of people don't even want a window seat. They're just not even fussed about the fact that they're basically taking off, flying through the air, seeing the world's wonders underneath them and then landing. But if you went back, 80 years, you know, the early days of spaceflight, if you went back like 80 years, the early days of air travel, people would have paid just to go up in a plane and see the world below them and then land in exactly the same place. So, you know, I mean, maybe there will be a market for that for a limited amount of time. And then maybe in 50 years' time, when we're doing this podcast as old people, old jaded space flight people will be like, isn't it amazing? Everyone gets on the space shuttle. They don't pay any attention to it. It's just like get their book out, put their headphones in, read a magazine. Honestly, in the early days, it was much better. You get up, fly and land in the same place and you'd be amazed.
So I don't get a window seat, Simon, but that's because I am pretty scared of flying. And I do appreciate the fact that I am in a tin can thousands of miles above the ground. But in terms of space, that'd be a daft question, but where would you be going to and for what reason? Like, I can get a flight, right? I'm going to a country, a destination, a purpose, a point. If I'm going up in a space, are we going to have hotels on the moon?
Space. You're going to space. I mean, bragging rights, isn't it? Right. So first, the first bit, initially, I suspect the first paid for space flights will be purely for bragging rights and the experience. No, sorry, I correct that. I believe they will be for the experience of going into space, seeing the Earth from space, and bragging rights, so that you can say, I've been to space. And then, they're probably going to have to start upping the ante. The moon. Mars is quite a long way away, though, isn't it? So I'm not quite sure. Maybe it'll be, where did you go on holiday? Oh, I went to Portugal. Oh, right. Oh, yeah, we went to Portugal, but we went via space.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Would it be quicker going to perhaps Australia through space travel?
Well, theoretically, it's further.
Well, no, technically, but you can go faster, can't you? I don't know, Simon.
I don't know. And this
what's
is what,
the point?
And this is why I would need to do more research before investing in the Space Investment Trust.
Exactly.
But here's a question for you both before we finish. If someone said to you, Georgie, Grace, I've got you a seat. You can go to space and come back. Land in exactly the same place, but you can go to space just for the experience. Come back down. It's perfectly safe. Would you go?
Yeah.
No. Not a chance.
I think I'd go, but I definitely think it's a bit high risk.
You're saying it's safe. There's no guarantee. Absolutely no guarantee. You can watch films with good visuals of space, CGI now. That's how I see it.
Nah. I can't live life saying, you have to be risk-free, do we? It's never going to happen. We're never going to live a risk-free life, everybody. I have a question, though, Simon. If you were to put, because we've spoken about Bitcoin, we've spoken about sneakers, and we've spoken about space, right? If you were to put them in the kind of list of 1, 2, 3 most risky things to think about investing in, where would you put them? Sneakers, Bitcoin, space.
Ooh. Okay, right. And I'm gonna make this highly controversial.
Okay.
I'm putting Bitcoin most risky, right? Hugely volatile, only been around for a relatively short period of time, potentially a long-term store of value, potentially not, Sneakers second, because sneaker investing has been around for longer than Bitcoin investing, and sneakers have possibly therefore arguably proved to be a longer term store of value and a genuine collectible for a reason, because they're a tangible thing. You can hold them in your hand, put them on your feet. And then Space Investment Trust, because these are real companies doing real things with the ability to make profits.
All right then, Simon, controversial, like it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into or a way you'd like Simon to reorder that because you don't think he's right. Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. Join in the debate and read the comments. And if you do want to contact us and offer us a free flight to space, please feel free to.
Although not Grace, because she's not interested. Although some really expensive, legit trainers or sneakers, whatever, I think she's on board for. Yeah? Great. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.